Welcome to the Lost Debate, a show for political eclectics. I'm Ravi Gupta, and later in this episode, I'll be speaking to a reporter from the 74 all about some data coming out about what the educator experiences in 2024, everything from artificial intelligence to school shootings. And so stay tuned for that. But before we get there, obviously, there's a lot happening in the country as it relates to this Israel-Palestine protests that are going on. But I don't. Before we even get to that, I want to start with what's actually happening in the war, because what's actually maddening about the coverage is as all of this is going on with the United States, these protests calling for a ceasefire and all that, there's actually a ceasefire on the table right now. And depending on how you read the reporting, we might be closer than we've been in a while to an actual ceasefire. What we know about this right now is that Israel's put on the table a 40-day ceasefire in exchange for 33 prisoners, which is the vast majority of outstanding prisoners left. By most accounts, there's probably 40-some-odd prisoners left. Israel wanted 40. Hamas had recently countered 20, but it seems like they're getting close, and that would be a 40-day ceasefire. Hamas wants permanent end to the fighting. So that's where things are right now, and it looks like regional leaders, whether it's the Saudi Arabians, the Egyptians, the Qataris, all are dropping quotes in the press saying that they're cautiously optimistic here. And it seems like the key decision maker right now, and obviously this is really hard to confirm given how much smoke often there is in this kind of reporting, is Sinwar, the leader of Hamas, who is underground somewhere in Gaza, is probably the key decision maker here. There are some Hamas negotiators who are expected to be in Egypt on Monday, and Israel is sending their own negotiators as well. The United States, Blinken, as well as David Cameron, and the Foreign Secretary of the UK, Cameron is in Riyadh, said the deal was for a sustained 40-day ceasefire. This would be roughly in line with the six-week pause that negotiators had been working to for a while. He seemed optimistic as well, seemed to think this was a good deal. And right now, as things stand, Israel maintains a pretty strong presence in central Gaza. They've split the strip in two. Hamas wants to make it back to northern Gaza. And it seems like there is a looming assault on Rafah that may or may not go forward, depending on the ceasefire. And it's hard to tell whether Israel is kind of gearing up for that assault because they want to pressure Hamas into a ceasefire or whether they truly want to go through with that assault. The United States has cautioned Israel against performing that assault without any clear alternatives or plan. But Israel has called up two reserve battalions, and charities have started to set up tent cities in the expectation that they're going to be drawing people come away from Rafah. And so this is, and the U.S. has said they, quote, have not seen a plan that gives us confidence that civilians can be effectively protected. This is kind of decision point right now. And this is why I think this should really be leading the news more than the protests. But I also think they're related to the protests for reasons that I'll talk about in a second. What's fascinating is there's a lot of different goals that Israel may or may not have. And if you listen to our coverage on this, one of the things that I find puzzling is it's not always obvious what Israel's goals are. And I think given it's a divided government, it's kind of a unity government or a divided government, depending on how you want to characterize it, you're getting different statements from different leaders. But one underrated element of what Israel seems to really want here is a change to the border between Gaza and Egypt at the Rafah crossing. Because what has been reported in a lot of Israeli press is that Israel was actually stunned by the level of underground infrastructure and arms that had come in ostensibly from Egypt, which on the surface was trying to stop the flow of said things over that crossing. And so what Israel is going to want is to push that border back to what's called the Philadelphia line, and the border between Gaza and Sinai, and basically decimate all of the tunnel infrastructure. And so that's going to be a sort of kind of a secret little element here that probably isn't getting enough attention. You know, there's obviously other elements of the negotiations, whether it's for a ceasefire or an ultimate plan. What are the borders? Is Hamas allowed to come back to power? Is there an international coalition? Is it the Palestinian Authority? What kind of security arrangements are made, et cetera? This is a big deal. There is also internal dissent going on within Israel itself. There are daily protests that are growing. About 2,000 protesters packed the streets near the Israeli military headquarters in Tel Aviv on Monday. They were lighting fires and threatening to block major highways. Benny Gantz, who's a member of the opposition, who's been a member of the Unity government, has said that any government that blocked a hostage deal would have, quote, no right to exist. He said entering Rafah is important in our long-term campaign against Hamas, but the return of hostages captured on October 7th is of much greater importance. So this is a key distinguishing factor between the opposition and Netanyahu's government. Netanyahu's government really is emphasizing the Rafah campaign, decimating Hamas, and then saying they also care about the hostages, whereas the orders flipped for Gantz. He's saying that the hostages are the number one priority and the other security campaigns, elements of the Rafah campaign and all this other stuff is also important, but the main priority needs to be the hostages. That is a key distinguishing factor between the two. Some people might look at that and say it's irrelevant, like they're basically all asking for the same thing. But I do think it matters when it comes to the ceasefire, because if your priority is the decimation of Hamas, the ceasefire could be an inconvenience. Whereas if your priority is the return of any living hostages, this could be as important as anything else that happens in the war, is to get back as many of those people today as possible, especially if there's going to be a Rafah campaign after this, because then a lot of those hostages could die. So with all of that, you know, maybe by the time this airs, we'll know more. But as we sit here, there's some hope that there could be a ceasefire, right? And look, a temporary ceasefire of 40 days could be the basis for something longer term. You all know the history. If you listen to the history I've done, ceasefires are often just an opportunity to reload in this conflict too. So I don't want to be totally idealistic about it, but it's a possible opportunity to thaw things and obviously give a humanitarian corridor and try to save some lives and avoid the worst of the catastrophe. Also allow aid groups to set up, allow more food to get in, and allow everybody to take a breather, right? Speaking of, there's been a lot going on as it relates to these protests inside the United States. As I'm recording, there was a deadline yesterday that the university officials gave to students at Columbia, which obviously is where a lot of the attention has been across the country, where they were given to 2 p.m. to leave the sort of green. And the students have not only stayed, but they have taken over and barricaded themselves inside of an academic building overnight, which is called the Hamilton Building. And they've renamed the building, and they don't appear to be leaving. Columbia's president had also said recently that she does not plan to use the police. And I suspect these two things might be related. Question I have is how this was even possible, because this is the same building that a lot of prior protests have taken place, like in 68. Over the Vietnam War and apartheid. This is kind of a historic building at the Columbia campus. How they allowed students to enter that building and take it over is beyond me. But I think as of this recording, so now they both have the lawn, the Great Lawn in Columbia, and this building. And the students, according to the videos I was seeing, were knocking out windows and using tables and chairs to barricade and obviously chanting. And they are, we went through a bunch of their demands last time. They're asking for disinvestment. They're asking for the university to call for a ceasefire. What I think is fascinating here is there's been a lot of reporting and movement on who these students are and who their leaders are. There was a video that was making the rounds on the internet last week by this student named Kaimani James, who is a leader of the Columbia students. And he was a prominent enough leader that he led a news conference earlier in that week, which I think is what got him some attention. And a video was circulated from a few months earlier in which he had said, "Zionists don't deserve to live," and was under investigation. And the video was of a disciplinary hearing that he had where he was being pressed to explain that comment. Listen to a brief clip from that video.
"Zionists, along with all white supremacists, need to not exist because they actively kill and harm vulnerable people. They stop the world from progressing. And so be glad, be grateful that I'm not just going out and murdering Zionists. Zionists, they don't deserve to live comfortably, let alone Zionists don't deserve to live. The same way we're very comfortable accepting that Nazis don't deserve to live, fascists don't deserve to live, racists don't deserve to live, Zionists, they shouldn't live in this world. And if we're truly living life and living in this world in order to achieve peace, the existence of Nazis, white supremacists, Zionists, these are all the same people. The existence of them and the projects they have built, i.e. Israel, it's all antithetical to peace. And so, yes, I feel very comfortable calling for those people to die.
So there's a few things about this that I find notable. One is the student himself videoing himself in a disciplinary hearing and doesn't seem to be apologetic at all. You know, he's saying things like, I don't fight to injure or there will be a winner or loser. I fight to kill. He's written before when he's asked, do you see that this is problematic in any way? He says, no. He kind of equates Zionists with Nazis and says, these are all the same people. The existence of them and the projects they've built, i.e. Israel, is antithetical to peace, is antithetical to peace. So I'm very comfortable calling for those people to die. Seems pretty clear on this and seems so confident that he videoed himself in his own disciplinary hearing, and he has now been suspended and he issued an apology and tried to distance himself from the movement that he's been a leader of. His background is he was raised in Boston. He's a graduate of Boston Latin Academy and was an anti-testing advocate apparently there. And he has told the Banner, the student newspaper at Columbia, that his ultimate destination is Congress, which is fascinating. A lot of people, I think this has prompted a very interesting online discussion about like, how did this guy get into Columbia? If you listen to him speak in this video, I would say, at least to me, as a former educator, I do not see a lot of rigorous thinking, regardless of whether you agree or disagree with him. There's a lot of generalizations. There's not a lot of precision. There's not a lot of generosity of spirit. And as I talked about in the last episode, there's just a lot of moves, you know, when it comes to logic, reason, liberal values, kindness that seem to be missing from the student. And I think this prompts me to double down on my take that we need objective measures when we're admitting students into these universities. And I think what the sort of protesters will say is that he is not representative of the protests. And I think this is a debate that needs to be had, right? I played a video last week of protesters outside the university saying, Hamas, make us proud, take another soldier out, burn Tel Aviv to the ground. And so I do have questions about, well, it seems like we keep seeing videos like this, and these are not just one person. These are crowds chanting these types of things, crowds taking on pro-Hamas views, leaders of these student groups expressing what I would characterize as pro-war sentiments, right? These are supposedly anti-war protesters who are calling for the burning of cities to the ground, who are celebrating militant organizations like Hamas, and in certain extreme cases are calling on death to Jews. Right? That is a pro-war message, not an anti-war message. And I think we should characterize them as such. And there's a really good piece that we'll link to in the show notes from Jonathan Chait in New York Magazine called Why the Right Loves Anti-Israel Encampments. And he quotes from Chris Rufo, who said the following, this encampment escalation divides the left, alienates influential supporters, and creates a sense of chaos that will move people against it. The correct response from the right is to create the conditions for these protests to flourish in blue cities and campuses while preventing them in red cities and campuses. So Chait basically goes on to say, all right, this is obviously like very convenient for the right. And then he goes on to talk about, well, the protesters and what they say, where this is coming from, right? And he says, quote, the best way to understand the beliefs of these protests is to read the published statements of the groups organizing them. That is especially true when the protests are well organized by an established network. In this case, the protests have been organized by Students for Justice in Palestine, an organization that's existed for decades alongside other left-wing protest groups. And their position is totally explicit. They believe in the total destruction of Israel as a state by any means, including violence. Not every protester joining the encampments shares this goal, of course, but it is the goal of the people directing the protests. That is why their slogans and chants call for elimination rather than coexistence. It was instructive when left-wing Israel critic Norman Finkelstein pleaded with protesters at Columbia to change their slogan from "the river to the sea, Palestinians," rather than "Palestine will be free," only for protesters to mock him by immediately repeating the original chant. And then he goes on to talk about the various leaders across the country of this movement and a lot of these, you know, sort of inconvenient positions that they have taken on. In an alternative view, Will Creeley, who is a senior leader at FIRE, which is a group that Bricky's been associated with that is pro-free speech on campus, he wrote a piece in The Atlantic saying colleges are failing at free speech. And he said, quote, "But no First Amendment exception exists for hate-filled speech, and for good reason. In our pluralistic democracy, everyone has their own subjective idea of what, if any, speech is too hateful to hear, making an objective definition impossible. And empowering the government to draw that line will inevitably silence dissent. At UT, the officers arrested scores of protesters for trespassing, but the students don't appear to have violated any school rules. And you can't trespass on a place where you have the right to be, as students at the public universities they attend clearly do. Even a cameraman for a local news station was tackled and arrested. The next day, the Travis County Attorney's Office dropped all trespassing charges for lack of probable cause, a telling indicator of the disturbingly authoritarian response. Shockingly, the cameraman does face a felony charge for allegedly assaulting a police officer, an allegation difficult to square with video of his arrest. The government can't throw Americans in jail for exercising their First Amendment right to peaceful protest." I think with all of these positions in mind, there's a reasonable position to take, which is peaceful demonstrations, even if they're espousing pro-war violent rhetoric, which I think a lot of these folks are, is still protected speech, right? Unless it's a clear and present danger where they're saying, which in the case of this student at Columbia, where he's saying kill all Zionists, if he's really uttering that in an environment where he's actually urging people in front of him to kill all Zionists, then that would be a bit of the fire in a crowded theater type of situation and would probably get him into some legal trouble. But I think in general, the kind of stuff he was saying in this unflattering disciplinary hearing where he's like, "I haven't killed any Zionists, of course." And he's kind of equating it with like a wartime mentality that like there are people who are put in certain situations and they have to fight and yada, yada, yada. Even though I don't agree with the particular things he's saying, is still protected speech, and he has a right to be wrong about that, and we should debate that. But that's different than, you know, breaking into the Hamilton building, barricading it, breaking windows, and basically taking over a space that's an academic space that your fellow students and professors and other members of the university community are entitled to use. It's a private space. It is also true of the green that you occupy, which is also space that has rules and regulations about how to use it, and also is going to be used very soon for graduation, or would have been used for graduation from parents who've spent upwards of $350,000 over 4 years to send their kids. They have are entitled to use that space as well. So I agree with Will that we should never lock people up just for what they say, unless what they're saying is motivated out of a proximal desire to cause physical harm to somebody in front of them. At the same time, if you break laws, you destroy property, you take up space that other people are legally entitled to, then you should be protested, right? Like if a pro-whatever protester wanted to walk into my apartment and chant at me, I would have them arrested. But if they were chanting outside my window, I would not, right? These are two different things. So a couple of things here on these protests. Number one, and I really, really mean this, for the protesters, be specific. When you say things like kill Zionists or from the river to the sea or Hamas make us proud, burn Tel Aviv to the ground, and then people get upset over those things. And then you say, well, I didn't mean kill all Zionists or the river to the sea could mean a lot of different things. Well, when you say those things, it is your responsibility to be specific and to explain what you mean, because the plain reading of most of these things is quite apparent to most people, right? And so I think this was a rhetorical trick that sort of the pro-CRT people were, when CRT was actually a thing being advocated on the left for a period of time, people were like, well, I'm for CRT. And then the right painted it in the whatever ways they painted it. And then people are like, well, CRT hasn't been used. It's a legal term of art. It hasn't been used in years. It's not actually happening in schools. And they were kind of skirting the debate around all these other things that sort of super left people have been advocating within schools and universities. And they used that sort of rhetorical move as a way to get out of defending anything that was happening and that they were pushing for within schools, which is obviously related to this debate. You also have a responsibility to condemn anyone in your ranks who is espousing hateful ideas, and also just ideas that you disagree with. Because like, if you're holding a protest and a bunch of people have signs or uttering chants that are calling for violence, or even just have ideas that you're not in line with what you believe, then you have to have that debate internal to your movement, right? Every good movement has these kinds of debates, right? Like, my family came out of Gandhi's movement, which was a nonviolent movement in India, where Gandhi had to fight really hard. He literally had to starve himself to push for internal discipline for nonviolence. So this is not just like a theoretical thing, right? You have to really fight for these types of things. And like, in-group discipline is a big part of what a lot of people do. It's why, in part, I do this podcast, is I spend a lot of time calling out the left, which is a tradition that I come out of, right? I come out of the left. I've worked in Democratic politics most of my life in some capacity. I've been a Democrat my whole life. I've run ARENA, one of the largest Democratic organizations in the country. And I spend a lot of time critiquing my own side because I think it makes us stronger. Another point here is use your influence. You're calling for a Columbia University to accept a ceasefire. Why don't you call on Hamas to accept a ceasefire? I think it would be really powerful if all these protests all around the US that are getting all this news all of a sudden flipped on a dime and said, all right, there's a ceasefire proposal on the table right now. Instead of celebrating Hamas, let's actually push them to accept a ceasefire. Because I think what they will learn is that huge elements, and you know, when we had our guests from Gaza on a couple weeks ago, he made this very clear, is I think the protesters would be surprised to learn that Hamas probably doesn't want a ceasefire. They may be forced into one at some point by their allies. And remember, their allies in the case of Qatar are also harboring senior Hamas leaders within their country explicitly. So if those people are really pressuring Hamas leaders to go to ceasefire, they may push Hamas to do something they otherwise wouldn't want to do. But let's not be confused about this. Hamas doesn't want a ceasefire. They have never, ever been about ending this war. And, you know, if you want to know more about this, we'll link to the Hamas explainer that I have in our show notes. Like, they have benefited from war. And I think the protesters would be surprised by that. But I think it would be really powerful if the protesters turned around and said, Hamas, accept a ceasefire, and made that a central part of their plank. And look, say Hamas and Israel, like, make these peaceful demonstrations that are for peace instead of for war, instead of being about the river to the sea and burning cities to the ground, right? So that's my read on everything happening with Israel, Palestine. One thing we haven't talked about is this Trump immunity argument that happened in front of the Supreme Court. And on Thursday last week, the Supreme Court heard oral arguments in this case, which is called Trump versus the US. And most people who've been watching those oral arguments think that the Supreme Court is leaning towards either granting Trump sort of full immunity, or more likely giving him partial immunity and separating out what was an official act of the presidency versus something that was an unofficial act of the presidency, which on the face of it is very reasonable. But the fine print here is really important because as Roberts pointed out in oral arguments, and he looks like he's going to be a critical swing vote here, you could take an official act that we would still want it to be illegal. Like, a good example is an official act is appointing an ambassador, but let's say you take a bribe for appointing that ambassador, right? Like an actual bribe as president. Now, the appointing of the ambassador is an official act, right? But accepting the bribe is also an official act because it's tautological, right? What we're saying is there are illegal things you can do that are official acts. So I'll say that again. You could do something illegal that is an official act. Why do I say that? Because if that weren't true, this wouldn't be a case, right? Because if all official acts were legal, then we wouldn't have to talk about anything, right? And we'd say, all right, it's only an official act if you're following the law. Well, there would be no case. What we're worried about are illegal things you do that we classify as official acts, right? In this case, It's Trump using the machinery of government and intimidation to try to steal an election, right? And the big question is how much of that is an official act and how much of that is not. But I am not willing to cede the ground, as I imagine a lot of people aren't, to say that, oh, it's only the unofficial acts. Because look, like an official act of the presidency could have been the president walking out there and shooting demonstrators outside of the White House, and he could have done it under the cover of safety or just his prerogative as president of the United States. And that's still under the logic of a lot of these Supreme Court justices official. So what's going to happen now? I think the most likely scenario is they're going to kick this case down to the lower courts to parse through what is official and what's not official. It's going to delay this case even further, I think increase the chances that this thing doesn't get heard by the election, which means that if Trump wins, it may never get heard at all. And so I think that's the most likely scenario here. They could surprise us one way or the other. They could, I think the most likely way they'd surprise people is through blanket immunity. But there's also the possibility that maybe we're missing something and they issue a ruling that's a little bit more simple. So with that, I think that's enough there. I'll do more on that case with a legal scholar who can really parse through what we heard at oral arguments and also give us an update on all the Trump legal stuff. And we'll do that in the next week or two in all likelihood. But with that, let's get to our guest today. I think you're really going to enjoy this interview. Let's jump into it. Well, today I'm welcoming on Mark Kirlieber from The 74. He's written for publications like The Guardian, The Atlantic, et cetera. And he is a heavy hitter on the education reporting beat and has written a few stories recently that caught our attention. Mark, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Well, you have a series of stories recently that kind of get at what the educator experience is in America in 2024. Let's start with this article you most recently wrote about the crackdown on AI in the classroom. You reported on this survey that was conducted by the Center for Democracy and Technology, which is a nonprofit organization. What were sort of the big top line findings from that survey?
Yeah, this is a great question and a really critical survey. So certainly AI has really hit the education space in a big way in the last few years, especially this idea of generative AI, things like ChatGPT, right? And the Center for Democracy and Technology surveyed educators about, you know, how AI is being used and maybe even misused in schools. And one of the top findings is that in most schools and for most teachers, students are being punished as a result of their use of this kind of generative AI, using that to, you know, write essays or find answers to certain homework assignments. But the teachers themselves, for the most part, lack guidance on what is or is not allowed, right? What are the guard rails that are in place? At what point does a student's use of this emerging technology cross the line? Because certainly in education, it's a field that's all about experimentation, all about, you know, using the tools that are available to you. And there's a point where, you know, generative AI has become such a big force in, you know, in society that certainly schools are wanting to encourage students' use of that, but Where are the lines? Now, I will point out another survey that the center did last year with students, and it actually found that, yeah, certainly students are using ChatGPT for their homework assignments, but they were actually more likely to use it for questions related to their own mental health, which I personally just found that really perhaps troubling, perhaps, you know, certainly really interesting. That certainly can't be overlooked either. You know, how are kids really using this tool?
What kind of questions are they asking of the GPT about their mental health?
The survey didn't get into that, but I have written a story, and I wrote it a few years ago. In fact, even really before ChatGPT became this, you know, national phenomenon. But the idea that there are emerging AI chatbots that are specifically designed to help people with their mental health. And the idea of that can be really helpful for people in, say, rural areas where there may not be as much access to mental health professionals. But there are also, you know, some significant challenges with, you know, trusting a robot that is, you know, only designed to offer so many different prompts, you know, using that as a source for mental health care. I think, you know, a lot of folks are saying, you know, in the mental health care space that, you know, these kind of chatbots can be a tool, but they certainly shouldn't be a replacement for real one-on-one, like say cognitive behavioral therapy with a trained licensed medical professional. You know, think of it something like a journaling app or, you know, a meditation app. Those are tools that we can use in our journey to improve our mental health. But certainly those are not the only things that folks should be using if they need more than that.
Yeah. And just to reiterate some of these findings. So what's interesting is there's a tension that comes through the survey data of permitting AI while also cracking down on it. So the survey that you were mentioning earlier is conducted between November and December, and it said 60% of schools permitted the use of generative AI for some kind of schoolwork, which is double the number just 5 months earlier. So this is changing pretty dramatically. But it also said that a significant percentage of students have been, or schools have had disciplinary issues. So 64% of educators surveyed said they were aware of students who were disciplined or faced some form of consequences for using generative AI. That was a 16-point increase. So you both have an increase of schools permitting it, which is doubled since the year before. And then you have an increase in schools cracking down on this. It strikes me, Mark, that potentially the schools haven't kind of developed formalized policies around this in many places.
Yeah, absolutely. So one other finding in that survey is that schools are beginning to create formalized policies, right? But that, you know, some of these policies have not specifically answered to that question of like, hey, what is permitted or what isn't permitted? Where is that line? When can students get in trouble for something that schools are actually also encouraging them to use, right? It seems to me like schools are perhaps, when it comes to policies, are just a little bit behind the curve here, right? This idea of generative AI just really hit the nation hard, right? Or quickly, you know, it really emerged you know, there's now all of this attention on the value of AI in education, and schools are now playing catch up to create policies and to understand, hey, how can these you know, emerging technologies be used in the classroom, and at what point is its use unethical or dishonest, academically dishonest.
Well, let's pivot to another survey that you just recently reported on, which is, you know, we're now 25 years after the Columbine massacre. You reported on this Pew survey, which found that teachers are very much concerned about gun violence in their schools. Some of the top lines here are: among high school educators, 34% reported at least one gun-related lockdown during the 2022-2023 school year. 31% of those in urban areas reported that as well. And what's interesting here is teachers are reporting that they're concerned about this. Students are reporting that they're concerned about this. Parents are concerned about this as well. And there's both what people are worried about in terms of active shooter incidents, but then there's other gun-related violence that happens in schools, which is actually more prevalent. That's also showing up within this data. Was there anything that stood out to you from this survey?
Yeah, absolutely. So I've been reporting for frankly many years now about gun violence in schools. And there have been a lot of concerns in the last few years about active shooter drills. You know, there's this tension about preparing students for the worst case scenario, right, in a school, and over preparing them in ways that might scare them, right? There are examples of active shooter drills being carried out with like rubber bullets, essentially, right? Officers coming to the scene and shooting blanks down hallways. And, you know, those kinds of scenes have really caused a lot of alarm among, some folks that kids are actually being traumatized by active shooter drills, especially while school shootings are extremely, you know, disruptive and political. They are statistically rare. But one thing that really stood out to me in this Pew survey was the frequency in which gun-related lockdowns are occurring. 34% of educators said, hey, you know, during that 2022-23 school year, we had at least one gun-related lockdown. And those aren't drills. Those are actual, hey, we're red alert. Everybody needs to, you know, lock the doors of their classrooms and shelter in place. And, you know, I haven't seen that data presented in that way previously, just the frequency that, that schools are going into like this crisis mode. And, you know, there are a surprising number of educators who said, hey, we actually experienced more than one lockdown in the last year. Now, you know, I do want to note that one important point in this is that these are lockdowns. They don't, you know, related to firearms, related to guns, but it hasn't been confirmed, you know, this exact number includes like cases where there were guns. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's a fear of guns and not necessarily that guns were present in all of those cases.
Yeah, and I think that's fodder for where the debate is inevitably going to go, right? Which is, are we whipped up in a hysteria over this? And are we causing more harm because we're so afraid that these are happening, that we're inflicting trauma on kids just by the conversation? Or are we being appropriately precautious because of the increase in gun-related violence within schools? And I think that's obviously going to be a big part of the debate. Obviously added to that is Tennessee's recent law allowing teachers to carry firearms in certain circumstances. And that gets to some of the polarized nature of this debate, right? So within that data, there was a bit of a split between Republican educators and Democratic educators. Republican educators were more likely to support things like police, metal detectors, arming teachers. Democrats were more likely to support things like improving students' mental health, obviously are more likely to support things like gun control. Generally, you know, I don't know if you've done any work on this Tennessee law, but I'm curious to see what you think is going to happen there. I know that it's not like a full implementation of arming teachers, like districts and schools have to decide on their own to allow it to happen. But somebody who used to live in Tennessee, I think it's fairly guaranteed that some districts are going to take them up on this.
Yeah, of course. And you know, this is an issue that isn't unique to Tennessee. Schools in Texas and Florida, you know, other states across the country have already, you know, implemented the idea of arming teachers. And what's really interesting to me about that debate is the idea that most teachers, a majority of them, are not in favor of arming teachers as a strategy to combat gun violence in schools. But I do think that the political polarization that is present in these data are really interesting because it's a survey of educators who have presumably, you know, first perspective, you know, real life experiences inside of a classroom. This is their workplace. They work there every day. They know what really goes on there. And yet there is still political polarization that is similar along partisan lines to students and to parents who, you know, especially like parents don't necessarily have the same experiences as an educator, right, on this issue. And the idea that the partisan politics, you know, is certainly a driving force in how even educators view how to keep kids safe in schools, keep themselves safe in schools. I just find that really interesting.
Well, you wrote a kind of companion piece to this, which had to do with this case in Michigan, where Jennifer Crumbly, the Crumbly parents were held accountable for their 15-year-old son's mass shooting and are now serving long prison sentences. And, you know, the title of your article is A History of Holding Parents Accountable for Their Kids' Crimes. How in line was that decision with the precedent for parent culpability in kids' crimes?
This case is frankly pretty unprecedented because in this case, these parents are actually being convicted of manslaughter, which this is the first time in history of parents being held accountable for manslaughter for charges related specifically to their child's active shooting. And, I interviewed a legal scholar on this topic, and he was really talking about how this case really turns on its head the idea of a pretty bedrock legal principle that the people can't be held accountable for other people's actions. However, there is this history of parents being responsible stewards of their children, right? A good example of that is truancy. And this really came up a lot during the last presidential election cycle, the idea that Kamala Harris had really embraced this idea in California of sending parents to jail because their kids weren't going to school. And, certainly the idea there is, holding people accountable for, going to school or doing, staying in line of the rules. However, the challenges that presented were issues along, racial and economic equity. And so there are folks that are kind of concerned about that here, too, is that, so with the Crumbly case, it really does open up this new wave of, holding parents responsible for the acts and the crimes of others. And, what does that mean from an equity perspective as well?
Yeah. And you talk about this law, like you kind of go through the sort of history of laws going back to the early 1900s. One law was passed in 2022 in Nevada, which imposed civil liability on parents for negligence or willful misconduct if they allow their child, if the child's a minor, to possess guns if the child has been adjudicated delinquent, was convicted of a crime, or has any propensity to violence. And you go back, and there are these laws in the 70s that kind of cropped up that had to do with the concept of vicarious blaming. But there isn't a lot of data about what happened in a lot of these places and whether they actually decreased crime. And again, I think so much of this is attached to a political valence. You have two white parents who allow their kid to use a firearm. And I think in this case, they're not very sympathetic, no matter what your politics are. Like the mom, a critical piece of evidence in the trial was the mom taking her kid out to the shooting range, I think, the day before the incident. I think that was what the prosecutor kind of closed on. And that was the last piece of footage of this gun ever, apparently. And they used that, to great effect against the parents. But I think if you were to flip it and say, okay, an inner city family in Chicago where a kid is living in the house and the, a kid is, mom works two jobs and the kid's got tons of disciplinary incidents and has gotten in trouble in school and has been violent towards their mom. The mom knows the kid has a firearm, but doesn't turn the kid in. Kid then uses that firearm to kill somebody. Is the parent liable? I'd be interested to see if there's a consistency across the board here, if we're going to be applying these laws, because I think in both of those cases, the parent could be the critical agent, right? The person who's a proponent of these laws is going to say, all right, who's the critical person who could stop this? Like, it's a deterrence argument. I know it was framed as a punitive argument, and I'm sure that did a lot of the work here, but it's really framed as a deterrence argument. And in both of those cases, the parent is actually a critical actor there who can call the police and say, take this away from my child, or in the case of the Chicago incident, arrest my child for having an illegal firearm.
Yeah, absolutely. Honestly, you're talking about a pretty bedrock debate in the purpose of like our criminal legal system, right? Is our laws upheld and criminal sanctions imposed on people as a punitive measure or as a corrections mechanism? It is after all called the corrections facility, right? The concept that these punitive actions are taken with the hopes of reducing crime in the long term. Now, you look at the recidivism rates of people who are found guilty of crimes in the country is really high as it is. And that being the question here with this case is, hey, does charging a parent with a crime related to a school shooting, to what effects would that deter future mass shootings? Because it seems like that's ultimately what everybody is trying to do, right? Or everybody hopes to accomplish here is, we want to reduce the frequency that these tragedies unfold in schools. And does holding a parent accountable for their student's crime, does it achieve that goal? And I mean, certainly that we haven't seen that play out yet. But, I'm skeptical of the idea that a student, who's considering taking this action might reconsider because, you know, their parents might face a criminal charge as well.
Yeah, I think it's probably less deterrent for the kid than the parents. Like, it probably would incentivize the parents to be a little bit more energetic. But I think often these are broken households. Like, and I think part of the issue is these aren't always rational actors. I don't know. It's one of those things where federalism will be really interesting. It'll be interesting to see how this plays out in different places. The problem is there's so few data, right? These are relative, even in this era of increased school shootings, they're still relatively infrequent that there's not a lot of statistical significance and controlled studies on this kind of stuff. We won't really get a clear answer on this. And so I think that'll be fascinating. One thing that I think was a little surprising was how little pushback there was from gun control opponents on this ruling. Like, maybe you caught more of that than I did. I'm sure there was some, but it didn't seem to be a big priority.
You know, it is really interesting. I'm not, I can't really speak to that either because I haven't seen a whole lot of pushback on that. But I do want to pivot one, you know, and just make one point about some data that we do have. So there was a federal Secret Service report from a few years ago where the gunmen are most often getting their weapons from their families, right? So from their parents or from their guardians or from other family members. And, you know, there has been a growth in recent years in terms of laws and efforts to pass new laws on safe storage, right? The idea that the parents are required, if they have kids in the house, to lock their weapons. And this case kind of speaks to that idea, right? That is like another way that the parents are somewhat being held responsible for their kids' actions that, you know, hey, if you have a kid in the house, you have to lock your weapons. And if you don't, then you're, you know, and they use that gun in a way that, you know, is causing harm in a community, that they could be held accountable for that in that way as well.
Well, this is obviously a developing story. And unfortunately, I'm sure this won't be the last we'll hear this. I'm curious to see how some of these laws like Tennessee and Florida play out with, you know, armed teachers. And I wouldn't, as you know, as a former school principal, I'm not sure I'd love this idea. There's just a lot of different things that I could see going wrong, which I think arming teachers generally is different than having trained professionals within a building who have a firearm, like a security guard, or even like one teacher who's like the teacher who has gone through firearms training and security training and all that, if you can't afford a security guard. I think those are very different things. But okay, Mark, thank you so much for joining us. Everybody out there, make sure you go out to the 74 Incredible Education Reporting. Mark, where can we find you on the internet?
I'm at the 74. I'm also on Twitter or X these days, but you can check my work on, you know, the74million.org.
Thank you, sir. We really appreciate it. Well, thank you everybody for listening. Remember to rate, review, and subscribe. Our voicemail is 321-200-0570. That's 321-200-0570. We will be back Thursday with a really exciting episode.